So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
With a sledgehammer. Wait a minute. Up on the elbow. The sledgehammer. Mr. McMahon was going for the ride, but the game's got the sledgehammer. And right the head. Oh, my God. McMahon going to referee. Give the referee up. The sledgehammer! It came to the head! No! No, God! No, damn it! No!
The system broken, the schools closed, the prisons open. We ain't got nothing to lose, motherfucker, we rolling. Motherfucker, we rolling. With some light-skinned girls and some heavy rollers. In this white man world, we the ones chosen. So good night, cruel world. I need a moment. No one man should have all that power. The clock's ticking, I just count the hours.
Welcome to another exciting edition of Review Away. I am John Pollock, along with Wei Ting.
Yeah.
Welcome to another show.
Yeah.
You look excited.
I look exhausted is what you meant to
say. Why are you so exhausted, Wei?
Well, it's a Wednesday morning. Late Tuesday.
Early
for
Wednesday.
For some people.
Yep.
I guess the stresses of the weekend, or at least the activity of the weekend is still with me.
What were the stresses of the weekend, Wei?
Running a lot of errands.
A lot of errands.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of monotonous stuff.
Yeah, a lot of driving, you know.
Where'd you drive to?
Scarborough.
Oh. So not too far.
The worst.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess you drive to Scarborough every week now. You drive to Scarborough more than I do.
Man, last weekend was the worst because the DVP was closed.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant alternate routes, and it was one thing getting there. But then coming home, it's like I'm used to there's no traffic at that hour of the evening after 1 a.m. But having to take side streets all the way home.
Yeah.
Oh, red lights. It took me, I'm not kidding, from there to here, 45 minutes. Sunday night.
Yeah. It would be even worse, probably during the day.
Oh, it'd be awful during the day. It would have been double that.
Mm-hmm.
So thank God the DVP is open once again. They close it once a year for maintenance issues, which I guess for any major highway, you do have to take into consideration maintenance issues, but. God, what a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
I know I sound very entitled right now, but glad to have it back this past weekend.
Yeah.
What's your favorite highway, Wei?
The Allen.
The Allen?
Yeah.
Cool.
The Allen Road.
That's great. Is that really a highway?
Sure it is. There's no stoplights.
I guess so.
Yeah. What's yours?
Are you preferential to names over numbers?
I mean, yes. Why not?
The 401, it just sounds so boring.
Yeah. And they're easy to get confused.
I don't know if they're that easy to get confused, but.
401 and 407.
Not much of an identity to
407?
You know?
How many times do you think people from out of town thought, I should take the 40 what?
Well, they're not built for people out of the city. They're built for us.
What do you mean? Of course they are.
Wouldn't you think names would be more.
Yeah.
Confusing?
When you travel
to somewhere like New York and you have to get around, isn't it a nice benefit to know? I'm pretty sure that 32nd comes after 31st.
That would be assuming that all the numbers that the highways are named after are sequential, but 401 and 407, I think they're just kind of arbitrary. And then 427, what is that?
I'm sure there's a theory behind the numbers. Maybe they should get wild, like the 1045.
That'd be really confusing.
I'm coming up to 23,241.
Why don't we just use different languages? Why don't we name them Chinese characters?
That'd be fun.
Yeah.
That'd be fun to watch another country adapt to. Not so much ours.
Yeah.
Okay. Wait, were you excited?
This sounds like a local morning show. Yes.
Man. Is that going to wake you up?
No.
No, it's not. No, it doesn't. Maybe Backlash will away.
Yeah.
Hey, are you going to come watch Payback with us this weekend?
Depends if I'm around, but I'm not going specifically to watch Payback, no.
No, no, it's not going
to
be.
If I'm around, I will.
I guess there's no need for you to have to travel an event that you can essentially watch on your computer.
Exactly. Why would I do that?
I would think the company would be kind of an incentive that you don't get to see all of us on a regular basis.
Not really. You guys just like kind of put your heads in front of your computers and don't really socialize when you're watching shows. And neither do I, so what's the point?
Well, it's always a fun communal silence.
No, it's not. It's not that much fun.
Mouth is vocal.
Oh, mouth is very vocal. Yeah, mouth is fun. Jay's fun too, but... I don't know if I want to hang out with you during the show.
What did you think of Raw Monday night?
Great. What did you just get?
Sorry, I got your text message that you just finished watching Backlash. Oh, whoops. So we can start the review now.
Yeah.
I was dragging. Getting all your thoughts together.
No. I think I'm ready.
Well, Backlash, Mr. Ting, was an odd name for a show. When you think about it. I mean,
why is that?
It's like, here is all this great stuff that we have for WrestleMania and that we peak for at WrestleMania. And now it's the hangover period. And here is the backlash.
Mm-hmm.
The backlash to all the great stuff. It's like it gives an underlying tone that, okay, we gave you all this great stuff a month ago. Now here's the leftovers.
What should they have called it? Something with a more positive connotation, like
aftershock.
That's not better.
What would be something that is, you know, certainly you can't mirror the enormity of WrestleMania.
A reward.
Easter egg.
WWE Easter egg.
Yeah, now, it's coming in the Easter season.
How about victory lap? Celebration.
Something to play off of Lent.
WWE Lent.
Lent. Passed over.
Oh. April Fools. Is that a thing?
Not by the April the 29th.
Okay, whatever. I don't know.
Well, it's Backlash. Which took place that year, Sunday, April the 29th.
Backlash or Payback? Which name do you prefer?
Payback. To me, this year, I guess it's appropriate based on the year. For me, this year, to be quite honest, it's like this is the reward. Payback is the reward for what WrestleMania was.
Or it should be the pay-per-view where the WWE actually pays you back for the $10.99.
Oops, we got it right.
Yeah.
What did you think of WrestleMania now that we're a month away from it? It's an event to me that I just want to forget, to be quite honest.
No, for me, it was just like, it was a good spectacle, but not really, again, I think history will remember that WrestleMania as
a creative,
pretty decent show.
Misfuck.
But in terms of booking, a lot of things that didn't necessarily make sense in hindsight.
Yeah, I would say booking-wise, not wrestling-wise, but booking-wise,
yep.
You could certainly criticize one of the worst ever. And on a larger scale, I would say this year's WrestleMania, to me, I don't see it having any real negative impact on business coming out of it. But in 2001 and the turn of Steve Austin, it would. I mean, Steve Austin being taken out as the top babyface and being put into this character and role that I think the audience just didn't want to see him in was that really did hurt business. And they were hurt with a number of factors. It was the turn of Austin. It was The Rock leaving to go film The Scorpion King. So he would not be around, and Triple H staying on as a heel. So you did not have that baby face that was ready to take Austin's massive void that he was leaving on that end. The Band-Aid solutions on this show were The Undertaker and Kane, and they would even stretch The Undertaker program to the next pay-per-view after this. So this was in the shadow of probably the best WrestleMania of all time when they did a major turn that I think all sides would agree was a misfire. Steve Austin has always talked about the fact that it was a mistake. He pushed for it, and it was the bad decision business-wise to turn him.
And now why do you think, you know, considering that The Rock was going, considering that they didn't have that second babyface that they're about to push into that next level, why do you think they decided to do this at this time?
Well, I mean, I think there was the feeling that Austin has been this big babyface and we'd want to do something shocking at WrestleMania. Mm-hmm. And on top of it, Austin really wanted the turn. It was Austin that pushed for it very hard. And I don't think it was necessarily ill-conceived if you were to look back at how they had built this up, because that February pay-per-view, it was Triple H beating Austin in that 2 out of 3 falls, 3 stages of hell deal at No Way Out. And it was perfectly laid out for Hunter to flip and become a babyface coming out of WrestleMania. And when the night after WrestleMania, they were doing the big beatdown of The Rock and Hunter comes out, that place exploded for Hunter. They were ready to see him as that babyface. And I don't know what the thinking was on Hunter's part, but I guarantee you it was a calculated one. Perhaps it was, well, we've just turned Austin, and Hunter perhaps didn't want to be in that spot of the first opponent for the heel Austin, and you'd get maybe 2 matches out of that, and then where would Hunter's position be? So you doubled down on your heel side, and it left a big void on the babyface side that Undertaker and Kane certainly didn't fulfill, and I don't think they ever got there with Jericho and Benoit that they tried to move forward, and then we were deep into the invasion and that whole creative misfire. Yeah. So 2001 was quite the period when it came to the creative issues of the company and kind of the end of that 98 to early 2001 boom period.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the show, I think, that was kind of, it was the first show after, I think, the peak of the company. So this show at the Allstate Arena, which is where this Sunday's payback event will be, 15,592, a gate of $831,510, and doing 375,000 buys on pay-per-view. And it opened up with a video built around the two-man power trip, Steve Austin and Triple H, with the tagline, "He who has the gold has the power, he who has the gold has the power." And he who has the gold has the power,
and
he who has... Oh, sorry, I said it wrong. I just repeated the line. Yeah. He who has the power has the gold.
Okay.
So it's one and the same.
Got it.
And this main event would feature the major titles with Austin holding the WWF title, Triple H the Intercontinental title, and Undertaker and Kane the tag titles.
Mm.
So all of these titles up for grabs. And what a time period coming out of WrestleMania where they had to get this main event set around all of the titles. So we had, after WrestleMania, you had Edge and Christian win that big TLC match, dropping the tag titles on TV to The Undertaker and Kane.
Mm-hmm.
We had the IC title that bounced around from Jericho to Hunter to Jeff Hardy back to Hunter going into this pay-per-view. That was all in the span of a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. Why? Weird.
It was for Jericho. He just dropped this title to get it to Hunter and then was never booked to even care. Never even went after a rematch or anything like that.
Why the Jeff Hardy?
Well, Jeff Hardy, they put the title on him because they had done a thing where Austin and Hunter had just beaten the shit out of the Hardys, and Jeff Hardy won the title. And everyone was saying, wow, everyone thought the Hardys were getting killed in that angle. Look what they did for Jeff Hardy. He's made now. And then he lost the title days later. And Jeff Hardy gained nothing out of that. I don't think he was any further ahead after that brief, less than 1 week run with the IC title. And then he was a background player on this show.
Hmm.
So that kind of showed you the positioning and who were the main event acts at this point, going into Backlash. So big pyro to start off the show. And they had just wrapped up the one and only XFL season. It just finished.
Mm.
Memorable season, way. Yep.
Well, when are we going to review some of that?
An XFL game.
Yeah.
We should certainly go back and look at the XFL.
The finals.
The finals.
Yeah.
Did you catch, on the Edge and Christian show last week?
Mm-hmm.
A must watch now.
Oh, you actually watched
it? I watched last week's as well.
Okay.
Not as good last week's, I thought.
This
was with Gene Okerlund and Sean Mooney.
Right, yes.
They asked Gene Okerlund, they asked him, what did you really think about the XFL? And Oakland says, well, let's just say the XFL made the invasion look like the Sistine Chapel. Gene Oakland. Our announcers were Jim Ross and Paul Heyman. This was during Jerry Lawler's hiatus from the company after Stacy Carter had been fired, and then Lawler followed with her and walked out on the company. So this was a fun time, I thought. I enjoyed the Jim Ross-Paul Heyman combination quite a lot. They had worked together, obviously, in WCW together, and they were a great pairing here, very different from the Ross and Lawler dynamic. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Yeah, I really enjoyed these two, and when I realized it was Heyman on commentary, I was immediately excited to watch the rest of the show. They might be my favorite team in the short time that they were together. I think Heyman just brought another level of seriousness into the commentary that you didn't really get with Lawler, unfortunately.
Our opening match featured the Dudley Boys and Spike Dudley coming out. And then, after a long hiatus.
Oh.
Do you know what the deal is, Wei? Do you know what you're dealing with?
I think so.
You are dealing with not the A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O.
Yeah, I know.
Nor the P, the Q, the R, the S, the T, the E, the U, or the V. Not even the W, way.
Yo, you dealing with the X Factor.
I got everything I ever wanted, and I'll never give that back.
Yo.
Oh, I know you hate that factor, but you ain't gotta look at me like that. I said you ain't gotta look at me like that.
You are dealing with the X Factor.
What you looking at?
It will be televised.
What you looking at?
You run around pulling stunts like that. See, never in my life could I front like that. I ain't caught like that, I couldn't run like that. I'ma keep it non-fiction and take my hat. Remember back when things looked grim. I spent a lot of money and time on whims.
Yeah.
The return, Wei, of X-Pac, Albert, and Just Incredible.
Oh, I missed it.
It's all gone, that's the thing of the past. The fact remains that it moves real fast. So while you sit around hoping things won't change, I'll be sitting pretty singing, hey, Rocky Wei.
No, not really.
Uncle Cracker, Loud and Proud, in the Allstate Arena.
Yeah, I mean, really, the perfect theme song for a faction led by X-Pac. A guy whose gimmick at this point was essentially somebody who was going out there to be really lame, but not realizing that he is being perceived that way.
We cut to a fan sign. A fan that sat down for a long amount of time thinking, what can I bring to the Allstate Arena for Backlash? And he decided to write Dork Factor on his sign. And this was the sign of the night, Wei. This guy, which based on his apparel and his look on his face, this sign was missing an arrow pointing down.
Dork Factor.
Dork Factor.
Okay.
So the Dudley Boys and Spike Dudley taking on X Factor. Our referee was Teddy Long. And this crowd was so hot here for this opening match. A hot Chicago crowd.
Mm-hmm.
A double foot stomp by Spike. I kept in my notes writing Alberto instead of Albert. My fingers and my mind are just tuned to typing Albert with an O at the end.
Right.
The Dudleys press slam Spike onto X-Pac and Justin on the floor. Huge chant for the tables. Albert blocks the Dudley Dog, which was the rechristened acid drop, which I guess was not WWF friendly at the time. They got the heat on Spike. Loud chant of X-Pac sucks. Credible, and X-Pac then ran Devon's balls into the post on the floor. And Jim Ross was trying to coin the nickname the Wizards of the Wicked Wood onto the Dudleys, which was not one of their monikers that truly stuck.
No.
The Wizards of the Wicked Wood.
I don't know, was it like Lord of the Rings was popular at this time, I guess?
Not yet, not in early 2001.
Harry Potter?
Harry Potter. Harry Potter hadn't even come out yet. I guess the books were around. Mm, okay. Maybe they were just going for the WWW.
Or Wizards of Waverly Place.
The web boom. The Wizards of the Wicked Wood. They got the advantage on D-Von. It's a double underhook vertical suplex delivered by D-Von. Double clothesline by D-Von. Made the hot tag to Bubba, who hit a Bubba bomb to Credible. Side slam to X-Pac. Then Albert came in, missed Bubba, splashing X-Pac. They hit the What's Up headbutt. And this crowd, they were so excited. They were on their feet to see a man's head connect with another's crotch. They called for the tables. Albert booted D-Von to the floor, and then Albert splashes Bubba in the corner. Credible hits him with a super kick, and an X-Pac pins Bubba in 8 minutes. Mm-hmm. And the X-Factor are the winners in this opening match.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised about the finish watching it, but I mean, if you think about it, X-Factor were brand new at this point, so I guess it only made sense that they were getting the push. I actually liked the team of the three of them together. I thought here you had a team of Waltman and Justin Credible, two guys who could work a very fast, similar style. And then you had Albert, the powerhouse, to balance them. And, you know, the problem was I don't think they ever really found their personalities as a group. I can't really recall any promos or vignettes from this group, and I think X-Pac, anything that they were trying to do seriously with him by this point was sort of a lost cause. I really enjoyed Spike, you know, being paired with the Dudleys. I thought it added another dynamic to the group, and I think it was also just a really cool story to see a guy like a Spike Dudley, who looks nothing like what the typical WWE employee would look like, managing to make it onto the main roster and standing out, you know, in a match like this, a lot more than your typical wrestler.
I think at this time period, I thought, especially those six-mans with Bubba, D-Von, and Spike, I thought they just had great six-man like, they had the formula down so perfectly with the heat on Spike and then working to the hot tag. I mean, the Dudleys have so many great signature spots that involve crowd interaction, mm-hmm. that this was a perfect spot for them to open a pay-per-view slot.
Yeah.
Now, X-Factor then set up a table afterwards, and D-Von stopped Albert. They hit a Dudley dog to Credible, then a 3D to X-Pac through the table, so you still got the big pop. But Paul Heyman stating that the war between these two sides has just begun. Hmm. More to come in the X-Factor Dudley's chronology.
Mm-hmm.
A limo arrives, and William Regal, in his WWF t-shirt, greets the Duchess of Queensberry, calls Chicago horrible, and tells security to take care of the Duchess. The beginning of a very long and non-entertaining character throughout the night. Kurt Angle is in his locker room. Lillian Garcia interviews him about tonight's ultimate submission match. He says he is calm. He beat Chris Benoit at WrestleMania and owns him. And 30 minutes will feel like a lifetime for Chris Benoit later tonight. They showed highlights of Jerry Lynn's television debut for the WWF, defeating Crash Holly and winning the title on Sunday Night Heat, which, if that did not give you a sense of where Jerry Lynn would be slotted, that was essentially it. This mm-hmm. might have been his peak moment in his WWF run.
Yeah.
Which was an unfortunate misuse of a guy who was clearly a significant player in ECW and didn't seem to ever even get a chance during this WWF run.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, defeating Crash Holly when he hooked the trunks, and at least it got shown in highlight form on the pay-per-view. Hardcore title match was next. Do you know that they're putting out a hardcore title DVD later this year?
Did not know that.
The WWE will be putting out a DVD featuring the best moments
from
the hardcore division.
Okay, well, I probably won't be watching that.
No, there will be no review of that DVD on this show. Rhino was defending the hardcore title against Raven.
I don't know what had happened to the hardcore belt itself by this point, but by this time, as we all know, the hardcore title was the old Winged Eagle title that they shattered into pieces.
Yes.
But by this point, it had been several years, and I think all the gold-plated pieces had started to fall off. So by this point, when Rhino had it, it just became this kind of floppy, shitty looking piece of black leather that he would just carry around with him to the ring. Didn't look really even impressive as a hardcore bill.
Oh, it was supposed to look like garbage. Just kind of how it was booked during this time. Raven's theme, it's just like a bird, like summoning Raven to the ring.
Ravens, yeah.
Yeah. He comes out with a shopping cart full of weapons, and of course this is Falls Count Anywhere. Rhino attacks him with a trash can, knocks Raven to the floor. Raven sets up a chair on the floor, and Rhino leaps off the steel steps, but then crashes into this chair as Raven moves out of it. There is a trash can lid shot to Raven's head. As Ross notes, he just got his brain scrambled, and then gets hit with a sign off the barricade, and says, "When it comes to hardcore wrestling, that is what you call technique," says Paul Heyman. Rhino uses a shopping cart, throws it into the ring. There's a drop toe hold that sends Rhino into the cart, and then Raven attacks with this handicap sign, just these vicious shots to the head that one another absorbed. Rhino lifts the shopping cart, gets hit in the face, and then it falls on top of him. Raven then runs the cart into Rhino, more trash can shots, and then Raven staggers to his feet. Rhino sets up for the gore, runs at Raven, who sidesteps, and Rhino gores himself into the shopping cart. And then Raven uses a kitchen sink. Rhino kicks out. The crowd goes nuts, believing the kitchen sink would be the finish. And then Rhino gores Raven as they are showing the replay of this. And then Rhino pins Raven in 8 minutes and 11 seconds. I remember at the time thinking this was a better than average hardcore match for the time. And watching back, I find these matches really stupid in hindsight. No, but
I hate these matches. They're completely just soulless, without character, without story. It just becomes a showcase of who can take the bigger shots to the head with a metal plate. The spots aren't creative or impressive or built to, and I didn't enjoy it. And I thought Jim Ross as well was definitely kind of out of his element in calling a match like this. You get the feeling that he didn't enjoy watching and calling these types of matches. But of course you had Heyman there, thankfully, who was doing the bulk of the talking here and really working hard to get guys over, in particular Rhino, who he seemed to be almost treating like a personal project of his. Certainly it was, you can thank Paul Heyman for getting the gore over as much as it was.
The first 6 months in the WWF for Rhino, I mean, he was treated pretty significantly. I mean, not a main event guy, but certainly a protected mid to even upper mid card guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was his neck breaking later in that year where he missed so much time and he was never the same when he came back. But that 01 period when he came in, he was certainly protected in his spot.
And I really think you have to thank Paul Heyman for being a big part of that. I feel like if it was Lawler still on commentary at this time, I don't think a lot of...
It would have been animal jokes.
Yes.
This is, to me, the biggest disconnect to these matches is that the headshots are largely just played for comedy. You know, oh, his brain's scrambled. Oh, he's got his bell rung. It's just...
Or just kind of like, to show how tough these guys are.
Yeah, and I think we look in hindsight, and these are just matches that I don't think you can look back and applaud in any way.
They're actually ultimately just boring. Because, again, there's
the crowd
story.
Wore out on these a lot earlier than the company did. I mean, this hardcore division went another year before they finally got rid of that title, and the novelty of a hardcore match, to me, was pretty much gone by, I would say, mid to late 1999.
It was WWE thinking, that this was the only thing that made ECW successful, and how it got guys like Raven and Rhino over in WCW was the use of weapons, when it really had nothing to do with very little to do.
People got numb to the violence of it, where it was just the cookie sheet matches. I think they did find something new with the comedic twist with Crash Holly that he did get something out of. But certainly by this point, it was just... I think people largely tired of this. Though these two had some creative stuff working around a shopping cart, you can certainly say. There was an ad for WWF The Music Volume 5. A compact disc release by the company featuring the hit single Pie by The Rock.
Compact disc.
Yes.
Yeah, they exist. That's what I did on the weekend. I listened
to some compact discs.
I went to purchase some blank DVDs. I had to burn some DVDs. I managed to find a store that still sold compact discs and like blank DVDs and blank CDs.
I bet you a lot of Prince CDs got sold over the past week.
Yeah, no doubt.
Probably some records.
Probably a lot of downloads, but...
Probably a lot of downloads, but there are probably the sentimental bunch that would still want a Definitely. Physical copy of his work.
Yeah. When was the last time you bought a CD?
WWF The Music Volume 5.
Wow.
No, I can't remember the last CD I bought, to be quite honest. It's been... I can't even remember. Shane McMahon. Oh, God. They must have just loved this goddamn Shane and the Beanstalk thing. Because I swear they played this thing like 10 million times on the show.
Hello, Big Show. I saw what you did to Test. So I thought I'd try to calm you down by reading from this fable to turn that frown upside down. This story stars a giant, a beanstalk, and a boy named Jack. But for the purposes of this story, the boy will be named Shane O'Mac. Now, Shane had a dad that was angry and crass because at WrestleMania, Shane kicked his dad's ass. Shane's dad was sore. He could barely walk. So he called Shane out for a father-son talk. They stood in the ring face-to-face and toe-to-toe when Vince called out for the giant Big Show.
Fee-fi-fo-fum. I'm 7 foot tall, but me, plenty dumb.
Show grabbed Shane by the neck, picked him up off the mat, then chokeslammed Shane down with a ferocious splat. Vince grinned from ear to ear upon seeing the crash, said you two will compete this Sunday at Backlash. Once the match started, the giant looked high and low, but he couldn't find Shane. Which way did he go? Up to the top of the mighty beanstalk. The people were stunned. They can barely talk. The fairy tale ends with a mighty crash landing. And it was all said and done. Shane O'Mac was the last man standing.
This fucking book. By the end of the night, I didn't want to see this goddamn book one more damn time.
I'm pretty sure I didn't watch this pay-per-view back when it originally aired, but I feel like I've seen this promo over and over and again, and it was only on SmackDown, but somehow I had seen this so often.
It wasn't even witty. It wasn't well written.
They thought it was witty. It's for them.
God, it was just... Anyway, it's Shane McMahon. This was from a SmackDown episode where they taped them in WWF Studios, and to showcase that it was WWF Studios, they just had a camera, physical camera behind him for the feel
camera
of the studio.
And a light.
Yeah. So he reads this book. It's Jack and the Beanstalk with Jack crossed out, and it says Shane. And he uses the story to go through his feud with Vince McMahon and the Big Show. And apparently this entire story was written on one page because Shane never had to turn a page in the book that it was written on. Michael Cole is with Shane and his book backstage that he's still carrying with him. He packed this in his luggage and took it to Chicago and made sure it was with him in the arena. And when they told him it's time for your interview, he found this book to hold. Before Shane can finish, Stephanie walks in and wants Shane to apologize to Vince so he can call off the match, and says that Shane lives in a fantasy world and Vince lives in the real world. Two conclusions from this. A, we are having the exact same feud 15 years later. And B, Stephanie's voice has changed dramatically in 15 years.
Yeah.
This was a super high-pitched Stephanie in comparison to today.
This was little girl Stephanie. I think everybody's voices have changed. I asked somebody recently who was going through our old archives to let me know if he noticed.
I thought you were going to say, I asked someone recently going through puberty.
Nope.
Well, she would have been 24 at this point. Yeah. 24 to 39.
Exactly.
I don't know how much change you go through during those years.
I think your voice has probably changed quite a bit.
Well, I'm not 39 yet, so.
Well, even in the time that you started doing radio, I'm sure your voice has quite
definitely
changed
has.
Quite a bit.
It definitely has.
So it's not unusual. That makes me feel. I mean, I can't believe she's been on like this was like 14 or 16 years ago.
This was 15 years ago.
15 years ago. Wow.
And she was on TV 2 years prior to that. So that's how long Stephanie has been a character. And I mean, it's night and day, her performances. I mean, she was not a great character at this
time. She was just kind of, she was somebody who was comfortable, I suppose, in front of the camera, but certainly not the standout that she's become. Shane, though, I would say is still pretty much at the same level that you saw him here in 2001. I mean, I remember even thinking back then, however old I was back then, thinking that this was a really corny promo at the time. Now I watch it, and I think, at the very least, I appreciate the fact that it's different from your typical promo. You know, it's more memorable. He did have a prop, and he kind of had he did sort of a parody of the Jack and the Beanstalk, which is more memorable, and you can, you know, definitely say that it's left more of an impression than your traditional talking in front of the camera, I'm going to beat your ass type of promo.
How did we not get a Shane and the Beanstalk gimmick match?
How would you get a beanstalk into the... He should have jumped off the beanstalk.
Well, when you think about how the finish of that match was built around, yeah. I mean, it kind of played off of Jack and the Beanstalk.
Yeah, it's actually kind of brilliant.
The metal trusk was the beanstalk.
Yeah. I would have loved for JR to make that point, but yeah, that's kind of actually smart.
Like, the way to have done it would have been, it was Big Show... they're fighting on the top, and then Shane flees to the bottom and then knocks the metal trusk, and Big Show falls down to his peril.
Yeah, well, I don't think they would have done that.
That was not possible.
That would have been a perfect analogy. I also found it a little weird that, you know, Shane, who is coming off of the recently acquiring WCW, that he was...
Yeah, this was the first chapter of the invasion.
Somehow involved in a match with the Big Show as his kind of first task as the owner of WCW, and I could only imagine that they probably had this planned even prior to all that stuff going down, and somehow had to kind of shoehorn this match into that storyline.
Yeah, I don't feel they had any concrete plans for the invasion, mm-hmm. and I mean, as you look back, we won't get into a whole discussion on the invasion, but I mean, this was essentially the telltale sign. I mean, this invasion was going to be an extension of the McMahon family, where WCW was the latest prop
right.
that they were fighting over, and it was not going to be treated any different way. It was going to be the McMahon family power struggle.
Yeah, you had the Jack and the Beanstalk book, and then you had WCW as the props for this angle.
Yes. So Michael Cole finishes the interview here. Steve Austin then arrives in all camouflage alongside Deborah. Kevin Kelly, our guest on The Law this Sunday night, came and interviewed Steve. And Steve tells him to shut up, and he will not lose a damn thing tonight. The Duchess is shown in catering as Jonathan Coachman goes to interview her and asks about what the rules are in a Duchess of Queensberry rules match. Regal interrupts, stopping her from explaining the rules, kicks Coach out, and he apologizes for the commoners. Then we got a video feature for the William Regal-Chris Jericho feud, which was a rematch from WrestleMania, which involved Chris Jericho pissing in William Regal's tea. Then there was, of course, a go-to at the time, Photoshop, where Regal's face was placed on a royal figure's body. And Regal, of course, was commissioner at the time. On top of this. So all these things led into the Duchess of Queensberry match. If ever you wanted to ask questions about why did the invasion fail, my answer would be because the people booking the invasion also booked the Duchess of Queensberry match. They put time and effort into coming up with this match, and this was the end result. There was lots of heat as Regal got on the mic, bringing out the Duchess, who sat in this big chair at ringside, and then Jericho comes out, with Ross noting that Jericho debuted in this arena back in 1999. Once again, he brings up the Photoshop photo of Regal, getting their money's worth out of that photo,
mm-hmm.
and says, both look like men. What a slam to the Duchess here. And says, this is the Windy City, but the Duchess of Queensberry is the Ugly City.
Wow. Where is... Where do you, Queensberry.
It's right near Mayberry. Paul Heyman says, the Duchess is still mourning the loss of Princess Diana, which felt out of place for this comedy. Not to mention this was...
It's 4 years ago, though.
Quite a distance between the time of Princess Diana's passing and the Duchess entering the Allstate Arena. The rules are not explained as the match begins. And what this was Lance Storm and Mike Awesome from the New Blood Rising show, where the babyface would constantly win and then have the rug pulled out from him with different rules. Jericho missed with a missile drop kick. He grabbed his right arm. The crowd is chanting, "Regal sucks." Has Regal gotten control? Took a drop kick while he was seated on the top turnbuckle, and Jericho hits a Hurricane Rana off of the turnbuckle. Then Jericho hits a lion salt, but the bell rings, and Howard Finkel announces that the time limit has expired in round one of the Duchess of Queensberry rules match. And then Regal grabs Jericho with a schoolboy, and they continue immediately into, I guess, the second round. Then Jericho rolls through. He goes for a Walls of Jericho. Regal taps, but then Finkel announces, "You cannot win the match by submission." I was groaning at this point. Jericho goes over to the Duchess, and they fight on the floor. Regal then nails Jericho with the scepter. Finkel explains there are no disqualifications. Jericho kicks out after the scepter shot. And then there's a double underhook suplex delivered to Jericho for a two count. Jericho stomps him in the corner, kicks Regal in the balls, and then a baseball slide drop kick sends Regal into the lap of the Duchess face first, which was our sight gag of the whole match.
Fell face first, and then Regal came out of it looking like he's about to puke.
Yes. So, she reeks. It was the whole point of this, I guess.
She Duchess ovened him.
A Duchess oven. Wonderful way. Jericho then attacks the security, sends the Duchess into the ring, puts her into the Walls of Jericho. Regal breaks it with a chair shot and continues with more chair shots and pins Jericho at 12 minutes and 11 seconds. Regal left with the Duchess with handprints on his chest from the chops. There was no overcoming the gimmick of this match, the stupid rules. I didn't like this at all.
Yeah, I mean, this was definitely a match that would have belonged in WCW of the 2000s, for sure.
This was like an awful WCW idea from the year prior that WWF copied.
Mm-hmm. I gave this match like two tries, and both times I started falling asleep. And I think I just found the match itself boring. I remember Jericho and Regal not necessarily having that great of much of a standout performance at WrestleMania 17 either. And I wonder if it's simply because of the style of the two men, not quite fast and not quite high flying and not quite technical either, which was the strength of both men, respectively. I also, obviously, because of the gimmick, really tells me everything I'm watching in the body of the match is pretty meaningless. So, I'd say maybe one of the weaker matches on the show, unfortunately.
The Big Show enters Vince McMahon's office and doesn't want him to hold back on Shane. He says he'll destroy him. They shake hands, and then they laugh maniacally.
I like that, Show. I like that about you, Show. So, let me just offer congratulations.
We both know I'm going to be the last man standing.
Yes, we do.
Then we got a video for the Ultimate Submission match, another rematch from WrestleMania. It's the crossface against the ankle lock. Very dramatic music. And then Kurt Angle makes his way out.
This was an Iron 30-minute Iron Man submission match.
Yes.
Yeah.
30 minutes. Kurt Angle walks out and talks about Michael Jordan quitting and that this is a city without winners and instead has fat and sweaty pigs.
Yeah, still very much your dorky comedy Kurt Angle, who actually, he was great at that character, and I think it really helped him connect with the audience. But, you know, seeing what he's capable of as a serious character, this kind of comes across like a bit of a waste at the time.
Even threw shade on Roger Ebert here. Gave him two thumbs down. Yes. Benoit will squeal like a pig, he says, and again calls the fans fat, if it wasn't emphasized the first time around. Benoit comes out. Paul Heyman is explaining not just Benoit's time in the dungeon, but also spending a year in the New Japan Dojo. Right out of Jerry Lawler's playbook, too. How Jerry Lawler would have, I think, characterized the backgrounds. Ross says they have worked on their cardio for this particular match. Angle this was just interesting to watch as they tried to call like a submission based match in 2001 with their 2001 eyes.
Mm-hmm.
We had Angle in a north south position as Paul is explaining that Benoit is trying to choke him from his back while Angle had him clearly in control here on top.
It's a very interesting match to try to watch because this was, I mean, MMA was around, but it wasn't nearly as prevalent as it is today, obviously. And so the vocabulary of you know, the viewing audience and also the performers in regards to what a convincing submission match would look like, I'm sure would be very different today than, you know, back in 2001.
Yeah, and I would imagine the opinion of the time. I mean, here you have two of the best workers in the company going out for a 30-minute submission match. I'm sure at the time this was looked upon as great. I'll say this grappling match happening today, I don't think it holds up all that well. I thought a lot of some of the – I just think if you're watching with 2016 eyes,
certainly
very different. And you can't really hold fault towards them for a match 15 years ago.
Absolutely not. And also keep in mind, you're doing this for a pro wrestling audience who didn't have any knowledge of, you know, what a guard was or, you know, any of that stuff.
Which you could bring up is, was that a mistake?
I don't think so. There's no, I mean, how would...
this crowd was not that into this.
Yeah.
Until the end.
And I'd say they were more quiet, definitely. And I kind of blame that because...
I think the 30-minute step hurt that. They knew this was going 30.
Also because this is... And that's also why I like this match so much. This was a real departure from, you know, everything else that was going on at the time. Even matches that Benoit and Angle themselves have had. I thought it was a very daring choice to go out there and do a 30-minute match, no pinfalls.
Yeah.
Working a very shoot-based Japanese style in front of an audience that is not, has never been exposed to something like that. Not, you know, the results were very interesting, I thought.
Angle is constantly going to the floor when Benoit would be going for cross faces, and then they go to the floor. He ends up getting the cross face on the floor, and Angle taps, but of course does not count on the floor. Angle is frustrated and grabs a chair on the floor, and that gets stopped by the referee. And then Angle returns, takes Benoit down, and applies his heel hook, and Benoit immediately taps. And the psychology was great. Yes. You're going 30 minutes. You can't get your leg ripped apart here.
Also, the idea that I felt like these two were trying to treat this match like it was a shoot.
Yep.
And in a shoot, you don't have time to sit in a submission to reach for the ropes, especially for something like a heel hook.
And I thought the announcers covered that really well. I mean, the announcers, there was a lot of needed on their part to explain that, because if you're just watching with pro wrestling eyes, a guy tapping instantly, that's not typically a babyface move, but it was needed, I think, for the psychology of this match.
And on that note, while I thought Heyman and Jim Ross were great to have here, I was actually a lot more curious to hear somebody like Taz call a match like this.
Sure.
Taz, who I think, you know, this is the exact type of match he would have excelled in calling. He's somebody with more of the technical submission-based knowledge, and I think he would have added more realism to this match than somebody like a Paul Heyman.
He should have hired Jeff Osborne for the night or something like that. Frank Shamrock?
Sure.
Angle attacks the knee, and Benoit comes back, flips into an armbar about a minute after the first fall, and gets the tap from Angle.
So. Really, really cool entries into these arm bars. And just to see these two men, like, roll around and doing their transitions, I think a lot of that stuff still looks amazing today.
Benoit attacks the left arm, hits a shoulder breaker. Angle then holds on to the ropes, and Benoit shoves the ref away, and Angle hits Benoit with a chair that the referee does not see. Did this happen at the Eddie Bravo Invitational on Sunday? Chair shot as the ref was distracted. And Angle applies an ankle lock, and Benoit taps out roughly around the 11:20 mark of the match. And then quickly afterwards, Angle gets another submission, applying Benoit's crossface to him, and submits Benoit with the crossface. So Angle is now up 3-1, which established Benoit kind of as the underdog that's got to make up for the submissions he's down in the remaining time period. Angle then drives him into the announce desk on the floor. They get back into the ring, and Angle runs at Benoit and rotates right over to the floor with this back body drop. Big chops from Benoit on the floor. Angle and Irish whips him into the steps. An ankle lock is applied on the floor. Both are then trying for arm bars and blocking the other. Benoit applies a sharpshooter. Angle gets a rope break. And then Benoit applies a half crab while posting his knee on the back, kind of like the Lion Tamer setup, and Angle taps out with about 12 minutes left, so Angle's now up 3-2. And then he's just stalling and trying to run the clock as Benoit's trying to catch him, sends Angle into the steps. The crowd was certainly subdued here, I thought.
Yeah, I also found, like, definitely, like, towards the last 7 minutes or so of this match, it was definitely losing some steam. And I think a lot of that has to do with the Iron Man format and people realizing that, you know, you have basically 5 minutes here to tune out before you can tune back in.
It's one of the, like, the patterns of the audience, too, that when they had done Iron Man matches on television, they didn't do a whole lot of them, but you would see, like, there would be a big tune-out factor, and then they'd come back knowing that the final 10 minutes is the peak point of the match. So you're telegraphing and kind of taking out that spontaneity of when a fall could occur, or at least the match could end. Mm-hmm. Then there was a snap suplex to Benoit on the floor. They continue going at it. Angle traps one of the legs. Benoit's trying to break free. He does so with a jawbreaker. Pair of belly-to-belly suplexes is hit to Benoit. And then Benoit reverses an Irish whip, hits a pair of Germans, and then Benoit applies the ankle lock. And this time it's Benoit that submits Angle with his finish. And it is now 3-3 with 2 minutes to go. And the crowd picks up at this point as they're getting towards the end. Benoit clips the right knee. He continues to attack Angle. And Angle then applies an ankle lock. With 10 seconds left, the crowd is counting down, and the bell rings, and then Benoit taps after time has expired, and it ends with a 3-3 tie, and Angle is yelling that he has tapped, and then Howard Finkel announces there will be a sudden death where the first submission will win the match. They restart. Benoit is clutching his left knee. The crowd comes alive here for the sudden death period, and Angle is using the rope for leverage, gets swept over into the crossface right in the middle, and Angle taps out. They went a total of 31 minutes and 31 seconds, and Benoit wins 4-3.
4-3, yeah. I mean, I thought, seeing this match, I really don't have that much recollection of even people talking about it. Watching it now, I thought it was like one of those hidden gems that I'm very glad we came across watching a show like this. I thought it was a really well-worked Japanese shoot-style match, full of realism, a lot of subtleties in their movement and transitions that I think, you know, if you're trying to study these two wrestlers, you can go back and really take a lot out of this particular match. And again, I really appreciate them taking a big chance like this in front of a WWF audience, an Ironman match without the use of near falls. I think it takes a great level of your confidence in your in-ring abilities to do a match like this. And, you know, consider the idea that prior, even like 2 years ago in the WWE, there are no guys who are capable of working a style like this.
No, these would be, as you look up and down that roster, I mean, these would be the two to do this. I mean, you could, Dean Malenko, Eddie, at the time. I don't think Eddie would be really on the level of these three to do a match like this.
He could be up there.
But, yeah, it was certainly an ambitious match to put out there. I wouldn't put this near the top of the matches they would have. I wasn't as impressed with this match as you were, but I did enjoy it. I was not bored during this 30 minutes, but I think it was tough by putting the time limit on it, I think, for the live audience. And I think they had to settle in knowing that this was going to pick up in the final few minutes. And you felt that during the middle where they were trying something very different, which I do give them credit for. So after that, the Undertaker and Kane were strategizing intensely. Maybe they were just watching that submission match and going over some game plan for their own match. And Kane's arm is all wrapped up, and that would be a key point of the match after the injury angle on TV with Hunter and Austin attacking it. Hunter and Stephanie are then watching the Undertaker and Kane strategizing on TV. So it was very, and yet they were Undertaker and Kane were still appearing on the monitor that Hunter and Stephanie were watching. They didn't see themselves watching.
Like Inception.
Yeah, very weird.
Yeah.
Hunter is still wearing a month-old WrestleMania baseball jersey, and Stephanie says she tried to warn Shane about the match with Big Show, and Hunter says Shane has always lived in a fairy tale world, which I don't think Shane would disagree with based on his book.
I think that was the reference, right?
Yeah. I guess we're going to get page two of this fairy tale maybe later this year for control of the company.
Hmm.
still to come. Shane versus Triple H, 15 years later. Then there was a video for the Last Man Standing match with Shane stealing WCW from under Vince McMahon and trying to recruit talent. And this was the latest reset on the Big Show character as a monster and gives him the option of going to WCW, but instead Big Show chokeslams Shane and starts killing everybody, including Test. And Shane responds with a fairy tale and a custom-made book after this attack by the Big Show. And that was our next match, the Last Man Standing match. Big Show and Shane McMahon. And I will say this, there were an alarming amount of signs that read, "Which way did he go?" for Shane McMahon. Mm-hmm. I must have counted at least four of these. So you can't deny that Shane McMahon was certainly a popular character at this point. Shane comes out, assisted with his book, and of course, dancing his way to the Last Man Standing scenario. And and he's reading the book as he comes down the aisle. And he runs around the ring, tries to grab a chair, and slips away as the match begins. Shane climbs under the ring, escaping the Big Show, and then comes out, attacks Big Show with a kendo stick, and then starts attacking Big Show with the book. Yeah. Slamming him in the head with the book.
Hardcover, man.
Yeah, this was, he wasn't fucking around. Mm-hmm. This is not paperback. Shane uses chair shots. Big Show gets his arm up partially to block these chair shots directed at the head. And then Shane grabs this medical bag from under the ring. He puts on an oxygen mask and uses a substance that the announcers identify as ether and trying to ether Big Show.
Mm.
I guess he didn't succeed because Big Show, he did not die from this, but he did go down and it took quite a long time. I guess some attention to detail that Shane had or whoever came up with this thought of the idea of putting a mask onto Shane.
They also had the referee sell.
Yes, yes.
Which I thought was great. Sell that the thing was, it smelled really bad.
They learned from Giant Gonzalez at WrestleMania 9 with the chloroform deal on The Undertaker mm-hmm. to at least have the assailant also sell the effects yeah. of this substance.
Mm-hmm.
So Big Show goes down, and he's on the brink of defeat when Vince McMahon runs down and attacks his son with a chair, drilling him in the head. Big Show gets up and then picks Shane up, even though Shane was out, and beats down on him, throws him around, pulls him up again and choke slams him, and Big Show yells, "I'm the man!" Then he pulls Shane up again, hits a backbreaker when Test shows up and hits Big Show with a big boot. And Jim Ross calls him the young bachelor from Toronto, Test. They fight in the aisleway. Test uses the sign from the barricade and then gets driven into the metal truss at the entrance. Shane joins in on the attack, hits Show. Then Show pulls out a pipe and Shane runs away and starts climbing up the entrance set, which would be my escape plan too, from a big man with a pipe. Let's climb the highest point of this entranceway to get away from this man who is dead set on attacking me. He climbs up to the top. Test stops the Big Show from climbing and low blows Big Show and lays him out on the stage that is conveniently right there. Shane then climbs at the top. And flies off the top of the entranceway, landing right next to the Big Show. This one was kind of nuts because the prior one to this was at SummerSlam, where, I mean, that one was crazy too because Shane had to just fall backwards, which was nuts.
Yeah.
But at least he had a large target to land on. This one, if he was off by even a few inches, he would have crushed the Big Show. Like, he could have landed on his head here. Shane had to land close enough that it looked believable, but also missing the Big Show. Like, he could have landed on Big Show's head here.
Sure.
So Shane did have to position himself in midair from a ridiculously high distance.
And it wasn't like, you know, the Hell in a Cell where Taker just basically got out of the way.
Yeah, where Shane missing, it was on him. I mean, he also had to protect his target here in Big Show, who, I mean, Big Show, I imagine, was shitting bricks here watching this. I mean, time had to have stood still. As, just imagine the height that Shane appears to be if you're lying there.
Yeah.
Watching this guy coming down, and if he's misjudged anything, I mean, your head could be crushed in.
Yeah, it really is insane. Which one do you think was higher of all his jumps?
I don't know. I don't know which would be. I remember the Blackman one being just a spectacular height.
Mm-hmm.
I would guess that one was the highest, but I don't know. I mean, the Hell in a Cell one, it was the speed of what Shane picked up when falling off the cell.
It's insane.
Was
man.
Scary, the amount he picked up in that time.
Yeah.
So.
Really crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was certainly the big point of this match. So both are dead after this fall. And there was also a shot where the side of the stage in block letters, it read air filter. On this stage.
Yeah, don't you see those at shows all the time?
Yeah.
Air filters?
I guess that kind of, I don't know, might have taken the wind out of some people's sails. Could that not have been covered here?
No, I think that was the idea, is to trick you into thinking it was a real thing.
Well, anyway.
That was so that they had an excuse to bring that thing out there. But well, what kind of air filter takes is that? Like, what kind of what are you filtering the air in the arena in a giant metal wooden box?
I guess. So Test helps Shane up by hoisting Shane onto the jib and lifting him up so Shane is standing with the assistance of the jib camera,
mm-hmm.
Of the crane, and Shane wins the match in 11:54.
Mm-hmm. I actually really like this match. I thought. First of all, I think its placement right after the 30-minute Iron Man submission match was a very good move.
Could you imagine those two following this if it was the other way around?
No.
That would have been death.
No, it wouldn't have worked. You know, you've seen 30 people, two people have a very good technical wrestling match. I think it's time to see a dude jump off of some crazy shit and, you know, tell a very basic, well-executed David versus Goliath story. And, you know, I thought everybody will just remember this for the stunt, and I thought it looked tremendous. My only criticism is that perhaps they could have milked the anticipation for it a little bit instead of just Shane diving right off. But I thought everything was great. I thought the coverage and the production of it was really good. You know, knowing that they probably had a very big mattress down there. For the guy, it looked relatively safe. Well, as safe as a drop like that could be. Even the kind of ridiculous finish with the jib, I like the little details of them cutting to the camera with the jib as Tess was moving it around so that you didn't know exactly what was happening. And it all made sense. Contrasting this with the hardcore match that came before, I thought all the weapons, even like the ether, everything, the camera jib, it all had a reason to be there. It wasn't just, you know, and you were also dealing with this small man trying to face a giant, trying to beat down a giant. So he needed the use of weapons. It wasn't just weapons for the sake of weapons. And, I actually enjoyed this match.
Yeah. And I don't think the Big Show, especially at this time, he was a character. I didn't think he was in any way hurt by this. I thought he was in a relatively, I don't want to say nothing spot, but he was certainly not a priority on the roster.
He's where he has always been. You know, the fact that he's a giant means he'll always seem intimidating when they need him to be.
Mm-hmm.
And he could take losses like this and kind of be at the same spot.
The argument, which is similar to this year, is certainly that you were heating up this big WCW invasion, and instead of looking at any of the WCW people as candidates, it was Shane was positioned as this leader, and it was this match, and then 2 months later, the Kurt Angle match that is maybe the most memorable Shane McMahon match. How much was that necessary that Shane be the one in that match? Because you could have cherry-picked from a lot of guys that could have gained a whole lot from a match like this, from the Kurt Angle match, and instead it was Shane that got that spot, and he didn't need to be the focal in-ring participant for WCW.
Right.
From there, well, then we got some great stuff here. There was Vince with Hunter and Stephanie, and Vince is just pissed and says, as of this day forward, I only have one son, and his name is Triple H, unless I need a last-minute guy to run Raw every week. This was hilarious. It's just like, it's unbelievable. If you just, you pick a show like this, and it's like, we feel like we're in the exact same position today as 15 years ago.
If you just played the audio for this clip, you would have thought
it was unbelievable. Right down to, you could install Big Show to represent the interests of the authority when they come back.
Mm-hmm.
Then, God, you talk about, we're really scraping the barrel for DVD ideas like the Hardcore Division. I want a DVD called The Best of WWF New York Cut-ins, where most times, like 50-50, you're going to get a guy who cannot hear Jim Ross on his earpiece. And so was the case with Steve Blackman, who is asked a question reacting to Shane McMahon's stunt playing off of their match from SummerSlam the prior year. And Steve Blackman clearly can't hear the question and just after a pause – what's going on, JR? And he repeats, and he says he's impressed with Shane, mentions their match at SummerSlam. This guy could not be more of a drone if he tried.
He was definitely a black hole of charisma. Oh, I mean,
the black man of charisma.
Yes.
I guess
that. That would be The Rock. I mean, Steve Blackman is really just a stereotypical UFC fighter in the way that he's just... He gives this hockey player interview. But it also makes him almost a perfect straight man against a goofy comedy character like a Grandmaster Sexay.
Yeah, I guess. Grandmaster Sexay just appeared and tried to rap and did so terribly. And that ended the segment. And I don't recall this going anywhere. Steve Blackman and Grandmaster Sexay.
I don't either.
No. You know what? It didn't go anywhere because it was like a week after this. When Grandmaster Sexay tried to cross the border, and I believe they found drugs in his car, and he was fired a week later.
Yeah.
So that's why it went nowhere.
So this was maybe one of his last appearances.
This was, Grandmaster Sexay's send-off. Jim Ross says, this stunt by Shane McMahon is in another stratosphere from Mick Foley being thrown off the cage, which, with all due respect, I don't think is the case.
In terms of height?
Maybe.
Not in terms of how memorable it was, I suppose, but yeah.
It's amazing that, I mean, I always look at how WCW did that one stunt with Chris Kanyon that year at Slamboree.
Yeah, nobody remembers it.
Not a person.
What about?
And it was a pretty, like, it was certainly gimmicked landing on the stage, but being tossed off as he did, I mean, that's not even thought of.
What about Jeff Hardy doing his swanton off of the TNA set?
Oh, that was last week. That happened last week on Impact to close the show.
Oh, he did that?
He did this crazy stunt.
But, I mean, I think a lot of these types of stunts depend on the scenario and the stage that they're done on. I mean,
certainly.
Anything that happens at a WrestleMania, or I guess in Foley's case, maybe because that was such a big stunt on the first time in the WWE. But, anyway.
Time kind of... As time goes on, to be honest, I know it only happened a month ago. I don't even know where the Shane McMahon stunt. I mean, that'll certainly be a visual that they will show in highlight form, I'm sure, in later years.
The Foley one was the first.
I don't think you're ever going to ever come close to replicating the memory of that Hell in a Cell match.
Sure.
Because it was the most extreme thing I think anyone had ever seen at that level. I mean, you can find some stuff in Japan, but never anything that visually spectacular and frightening in the same thought.
Yeah.
Then after that, we went to, I would call this the death spot of the show.
Yeah.
A three-way match that when this was announced, I was super excited for this because Eddie Guerrero had not really had the opportunity to have that big singles match. And Matt Hardy and Christian, this was the opportunity for kind of the B-sides of their individual tag teams to get a spotlight on a pay-per-view. And this three-way match, Matt Hardy defending the European title against Eddie Guerrero and Christian. It was just kind of put in an awkward spot on the show.
Yeah.
Hardy had won the title just 3 days earlier on SmackDown. And the match begins with Matt getting dumped to the floor early. And Heyman asks if the winner of this match will also win the heart of Lita, who is, of course, linked to Matt Hardy. And Jim Ross says, no, win, lose, or draw, I feel Matt Hardy will always have the heart of Lita. Guerrero gets sent to the floor, yanks Matt by the leg to the floor, and then there's a baseball slide dropkick from Christian to knock both down. Then a back body drop by Christian onto the floor, bounces Matt off the ropes, and he bounces back with a DDT to the floor. Guerrero hits a pair of brain busters that Hardy kicks out of. Crowd was kind of just sitting on their hands for a lot of this, I found. Guerrero attempted a top rope hurricanrana, and Christian held on to Hardy's pants to block it from the apron. Then Hardy's on the floor, and Edge runs down with a see-through mesh shirt.
Mm.
There's some awful fashion from Edge in 2001, if you want to go back. This was the king of pleather.
And Christian.
Christian, too. Spears Hardy, and it leads to a near fall by Guerrero. Then Jeff Hardy runs down, attacking Edge. Christian hits the unprettier to Guerrero. Jeff Hardy hits a swanton to Christian. And then Matt hits a twist of fate to Christian and pins him at 6:52. And usually will lament run-ins to lead to a finish. In this case, honestly, the crowd picked up after the run-ins. I think they wanted to see Jeff Hardy and, to a lesser extent, Edge. And I thought they got more into this when you got the other stars involved here. But I thought, considering the individuals involved and the spot, I was kind of disappointed with this match.
Yeah, it was just an okay match. And I wouldn't doubt that perhaps these guys had their time cut short.
Possibly.
Late into the show as well.
Well, they had to make room for the main event, which had 30 minutes allotted to it, probably double what it needed.
Yeah, so, you know, these guys were in a tough position to try to get the crowd going after seeing that a man jump off of a giant screen, and they didn't really have the star power enough to carry it over, unfortunately.
They recap Shane's stunt again, and then we got the video feature for tonight's main event. Austin aligning with Vince McMahon at WrestleMania, then Hunter joining the tandem, and running roughshod until finally The Undertaker and Kane stand up to them. And, of course, we had all the titles that ended up on these four. And they all make their entrances. Ross says that The Undertaker is a real American and that the duo will be facing two rude Americans. Steve Austin and Triple H, where tonight they're going to forget their manners.
Huh.
And we got a big reaction for The Undertaker coming out to Limp Bizkit.
Yeah.
The Roland version of his entrance. Austin and Hunter are circling the ring as we start. Kane's left arm is all taped up. This was all attributed to the injury angle. I don't know if he actually had some deal going on. I mean, this is kind of how it would look if a guy was dealing with, like, staph infection. So it would not surprise me if he had something going on, but I'm not sure if it was or not. Hunter works over the left arm of Kane. Austin is in with Taker, who then got in control of the match as Austin is selling. They clear the ring. Austin and Hunter again go to leave. They get stopped by Kane in the aisle. Hunter stopped a last ride. This match went a long time away. It went a really long time. The crowd was a bit restless until Taker fought back, teased a double choke slam, and then got stopped. All three are down as Kane tags himself in. Hunter chops at the bat arm, and the crowd got behind Kane as they worked over the elbow. Austin hits Kane's elbow with a chair shot on the floor, and then Taker chases Austin away. They isolate the arm in the heel corner. Kane finally sends Hunter to the floor, and he pulls Taker off the apron to avoid the tag from Kane. Hunter hits a pedigree out of the corner, tags in Austin, who then goes for the fall, and Taker makes the save as the announcers don't understand why Hunter would tag out when he had the fall all set up. Stephanie then gets into an argument with Earl Hebner, and it leads to Earl shoving Stephanie off the apron and to the floor. Kane gets a near fall on Austin, and then Kane hitting an enziguri to Hunter, and then weakly, Hunter knocks into Earl, and Earl is like blinded by this casual knocking by Hunter. Like I've seen more contact of, like, a subway that comes to a halt and people aren't, like, holding on to the rail or whatever and just casually knock into someone next to them. This almost killed poor old Hebner. He doesn't see the tag to The Undertaker, who comes in running wild on Austin and Hunter. He hits the last ride to Hunter, but the fall doesn't count as he's not the legal man. Austin then attacks Hunter attacks the Undertaker from behind, hits a stunner to Kane, and then Taker and Austin fight their way into the crowd. They're taken out of the match. Stephanie runs into a big boot from Kane. The crowd picked up at this point. Vince runs down with a sledgehammer. He gets stopped by Kane as Vince passes the sledgehammer off to Hunter, and Hunter hits Kane in the elbow with the sledgehammer and then a shot to the head. Earl Hebner misses all of this. He is sent back into the ring, and Hunter pins Kane after the sledgehammer shot. At 27 minutes and 12 seconds, as Jim Ross is yelling profusely at the injustice exhibited by the heels, and our final image, Way, was Hunter and Austin on their way to the back. Austin is in the background on his way to the backstage area, with Hunter standing tall and proud with his two championships. And Hunter felt like the 1A to Austin's 1B here. I mean, this final visual was like, it was Hunter front and center here. And anyway, that's how the show ended. I thought this match would have been a lot better in seriously half the time. I thought this went way too long.
Sure.
Close to 30 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And this was not, I would say Undertaker post 40 had a lot better matches than Undertaker pre 40. To be quite honest,
I didn't think Taker was bad here, actually. I thought
he was fine.
Especially working with Austin and Triple H, who did great jobs, bumping for the Giants. But in the tag team format, I thought they were able to keep this match at a pretty good pace until maybe, the Kane sympathy spot, where maybe that was a little too long. But overall, I thought they were effective in telling the story of, Kane's injured arm and how, Taker was trying to protect him from tagging in, but Kane would tag himself in anyway, and then Taker would have to come and rescue him. I thought the finish was maybe a little overbooked, but overall, I thought the match was good.
Well, that was Backlash. I mean, I don't want to paint it as a bad show. I still give this show, 7 out of 10. This was when you had an incredible roster.
Yep.
Overall, I liked the show. I didn't think this was, though, one of the better shows at a time when the WWF was putting out some, like, kick-ass pay-per-views every single month. But that was Backlash. Where did you rank this? I can sense you enjoyed this more than I did.
I gave it a 7.5.
7.5.
Yeah.
We'll go to the message board to get some of your feedback. We start off. I was remembering the pop that Hunter got the night after WrestleMania 17. Do you think if they put Hunter in that babyface role replacing Austin and Rock that it would have worked? I think it certainly would have been better than Undertaker and Kane, who were really a band-aid solution to a lack of top babyfaces. And I think having the conviction to dig deeper and elevate a Benoit or a Jericho immediately after WrestleMania, because they would go with Undertaker at Judgment Day. And then it was the following month when they tried to kind of heat up Benoit and Jericho, but never went all the way with those two. And then Benoit got hurt, and then the invasion began, and it was kind of everyone was kind of lost at that point. But I think Hunter, I think it would have worked, but of course Hunter got hurt as well. So you would have been in the same position just 2 months later when he tore his quad, and you were in the same role of having nobody in that top babyface role. They lost Hunter and Rock for a period of time there, which was, that's a big blow.
Hunter, Rock, Benoit, of course.
And Benoit, yeah.
Yep. We go to Herman, who says, I remember a friend had a tape of this inside of a Backlash 2000 case, which really threw me off upon first view. The Rhino Raven match is very much remembered for it being one of the better hardcore matches. I feel it could have meant more if it had a story going into it. The Jericho Regal match felt like it was longer than the Ultimate Submission match. The main event stip has been done since this, and I hate this stip because the psychology of the match is winner of the fall wins the title. So Angle, Joe versus Team 3D had the same stip, and it showed my most heated pet peeve in wrestling, which is the tag team partners that don't get along. Question for you guys. Any chance you'll be in Vegas for the Figure 4 Wrestling Convention this summer? I met you guys there in 2014 and was appalled. by the fact that Wei Ting was real. Boom.
Appalled?
Or maybe he meant surprised.
He said appalled, like he was upset that you exist.
I'm sorry that
Who does he think he's listening to? Like me doing voices?
Yeah, maybe.
With myself?
Maybe an impression.
That would be creepy.
Vegas for, I'm assuming UFC,
200.
200? I don't know. We don't know. We'll let you know if we're there.
We go to McWhalen. Before I begin, rest in peace to China and Prince. Backlash 2001 had the dubious honor of following arguably the best wrestling pay-per-view of all time in WrestleMania 17. As a follow-up, it was fine, but nothing great. The two-man power trip had potential with all the big titles to be a true force in wrestling, but Hunter's quad injury doomed the pairing as a heel Austin alone was not enough to keep WWE at its mega-hot pace up to WrestleMania. When Austin turned heel, the WWE was never the same again, in my opinion. Looking back, it was one of the biggest blunders both Austin and the WWE committed to. The best matches on the show were the hardcore match and the ultimate submission match. There was nothing truly awful, but nothing truly great or must-see either. Backlash is a decent average pay-per-view and gets a 5 out of 10. Question for John and Wei. What do you feel was the biggest reason for WWE's massive plunge in 2001 after WrestleMania 17? Austin's heel turn, lack of competition, the XFL, or was it a combination of factors, in your opinion? I'll start. I think creatively, you can't place blame on the XFL. I mean, that certainly was a massive financial burden on the company. But from a creative standpoint, that really, to me, didn't have any impact on the on-screen product. I think you look back at 2001, 2002, and the creative direction, when you consider all the different things they were handed, that got squandered. I mean, you go through the invasion angle, the NWO coming in, even a year later after that with Bill Goldberg coming in. I classify all three of those as big squandered opportunities that came their way. Mm-hmm. So, business wise, the Austin heel turn was a big negative. So I think that certainly, there's no question that impacted business, but I think creative was hardly, at the same level as it was a year prior in 2000.
Yeah, I'd say the Austin heel turn and also the injuries and also, you know, The Rock not being around probably led a lot to the negativity there. I would also wonder if, you know, something like the invasion was more of a burden than, you know, a gift. Was it too much for these writers to handle? Were there too many stars for the writers to handle at this time? And, you know, did it all just kind of turn everything into a bit of a mess, rather than if that none of that had ever been acquired.
I think the invasion, though, you look back and there were so many easy options. I feel that it was just like, to me, it does take some skill to fuck that up.
How do you do an invasion though with a limited roster of a WCW?
To me, I mean, limited in the sense that yeah, maybe they didn't have all the stars, but even with that limited roster, look what that invasion pay per view did. That tells me the appetite was gigantic.
Right, and nobody came
when
back.
When Booker T and DDP were your main guys.
Yeah, and people didn't really come back after. I don't know. We won't talk about the invasion that much. You can listen to some of our other shows for that, but yeah. Anyway, we're to Alan in Osaka, who says, last time I saw the show was when it originally broadcast 15 years ago, but I could recognize so much from it. It's like I saw it last week. I don't think the show itself was so bad, but in the context of coming off of WrestleMania 17, it must have been a disappointment at the time. I really liked the spot where Rhino gored the shopping trolley, but I wish that had been the finish of the match rather than just something Rhino came back from straight away to win. I love Regal and Jericho as performers, but the gimmick of the Queensberry rules as a way for Regal to screw over Jericho should be on a Raw, not a pay-per-view. The last man standing was the same as the Shane McMahon Mania match this year, in that it existed purely to build up to Shane's crazy spot.
The Big Show match was much better.
Yeah.
Much better.
I agree. But in 2001, they had the sense to just use 10 minutes to build it up rather than 25. Although it features arguably the two finest wrestlers of their generation, I thought the Benoit Angle match suffered from the fact that it was just submissions. They deserve props for varying the submission holds they used rather than just relying on their finishers, but it resulted in the use of moves which just weren't over enough to elicit a crowd reaction, and for me that took a lot out of the match. The main event went far too long and didn't really hold my interest, but the extreme close-up on Triple H at the end, as though he had won on his own, irked me. I didn't really like the idea of putting all the major titles on Austin and Triple H, as it just felt like a necessarily desperate attempt to push them as top heels, as though the company lacked faith that it was doing the right thing. Do either of you know what the long-term plan for the two-man power trip was if Triple H didn't bust his quad?
I mean, I think ultimately you were going to get to that match. I mean, that was the only, to me, logical conclusion at that point. When he did tear his quad, I know that the original plan for WrestleMania the next year was Hunter's return facing a heel Austin. But at that point, they had thrown the towel in on Austin as a heel at that point. They flipped him after the invasion back to the role he should have been in, and thus Hunter got the Jericho match at WrestleMania. So that was where things go. But I'm sure, I don't know if they would have been able to hold it off to WrestleMania if Hunter had not gotten hurt, but certainly that was a match you did have to get to at some point. And there was even talk of, when they were discussing WCW and first looking at the idea of giving them a Saturday night slot, it would have been Hunter possibly going to WCW and being one of the main guys as well. So that was an idea thrown out. There were a lot of ideas at that point, but I'm certain they would have gotten to Austin and Hunter, and certainly that was the match I think Hunter wanted upon his return for WrestleMania. But it was just, you couldn't shoehorn Austin back into that heel role at that point. It was so done by the time the invasion was over. You had to get him back to a babyface. Mr. White from Particles Unknown. Great pick this week, as usual for this time period. Great crowd, great commentary, and a mix of good and bad content. There's one thing you can't call these shows, and that's boring. I don't know if it was because I was a preteen at the time, but everything the company chose to do seemed like a massive deal, and I watched the show like I would Game of Thrones or Breaking Bad. Instead of now, when I'm constantly groaning and feel like I could come up with better ideas myself. I was a giant Triple H fan as a kid, and this alignment with Stone Cold was very exciting to me. The show wasn't great, but it was fun to watch, and that's why I'd give it 6 ways out of 10 tings. Question, was there a babyface member of the roster that the company was building Triple H and Stone Cold for? At this time, it was... Well, you were going to get, of course, the big match with Benoit and Jericho where the quad injury occurred, and certainly that night... that was a massive win for Benoit and Jericho, and Austin and Hunter did an incredible job that night of getting those two across.
Yeah.
But then, to me, it was because the King of the Ring was going to be Austin defending against both in a triple threat, and the build-up for that, it was like they just gave up on them before we even got to the pay-per-view. It was a weird dynamic because you had the two baby faces and one heel. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Benoit as well. That was going to be his last match before neck surgery. And they kind of just threw their hands up. And that show did a pretty good number on – it did better than this Backlash show, and it did better than the Judgment Day show. But, I mean, those two, I never got the sense they were going full in on both of them. They kind of just – that was also during the time period where they had those great
– singles.
They had the singles match with Austin and Benoit, that Edmonton match with the 10 Germans. Like, it seemed like those two were poised for something big, but Jericho really, I mean, he became a player in the invasion, but not the main guy by any stretch.
Yeah, and I would also, Stephen, have my doubts if Benoit could have held that role at a bigger level, you know, without his ability to cut promos at this time.
Benoit, during this April and May period, I think what he did to his body during those 2 months, I mean, this was after this Ultimate Submission match, there was the Raw cage match,
right,
which featured the moonsault by Angle off the top, followed by a crossface off the top.
The headbutt
off the top. Like, just insane stuff.
Yeah.
Judgment Day, they did a 2 out of 3 falls match. Then Benoit and Jericho came back for this big tag turmoil match. They did the TLC match on TV. I mean, it was too much.
Yeah.
And it wasn't surprising that this guy's, you know, his neck got destroyed by all of this. Anyway, up to it's your piece.
Okay. We go to Kai who says this show was Extreme Rules before that show existed. It seemed every match had a gimmick of sorts. The hardcore title match was probably the most memorable in that title's history, and the Ultimate Submission match was a very good technical piece. Besides that, this show really didn't work for me. I hate matches that change the rules on the fly so the heel wins. Big Show and Shane was pretty dumb, and that final bump is kind of forgotten in the grand scheme of things. The rest of the show was forgettable. I feel they were in a lose-lose situation coming off of one of the best manias ever.
All right, next up is John from Indianapolis. Although I'd say this was a good card, aside from the Big Show Shane dumbassery that featured the WWE's biggest stuntman doing something dangerous, it does suffer a lot from the fallout of WrestleMania in hindsight, most notably the fact that there wasn't any top babyfaces to fight the two-man power trip, which I consider an underrated idea, after Rock got beaten down in order for him to go film The Scorpion King. Not to piggyback off of another user, but do you think the lack of a top babyface hurt the WWF? Yes. We've said it many times. That was a big issue during this post-WrestleMania time period for the WWF, was not having that babyface to fill the shoes of arguably the biggest babyface they had in Steve Austin.
Mm-hmm. Okay, our final piece of feedback is from Ryan from Calgary, who has a couple observations. Just Incredible looks stupid with his black leggings tucked into his white socks and black work boots. It is less silly in ECW with his jorts, but this was really bad.
Only one guy could have jorts at that time. You weren't topping Steve Austin if you're Just Incredible.
Rhino looks so much more impressive when he is skinny like this. Why does Raven have so much charisma? He's a great talker and solid worker, but there's something else that is just compelling to watch. Kurt Angle was doing twisters years before the Korean Zombie made them cool. With 3 mesh shirts, 4 greasy long hairs, and an epic mullet, the Euro title match was a fashion disaster. Maybe wrestling in general is a fashion disaster. One question, is it better when pro wrestlers use specifically worked submissions or versions of shoot submission holds? Most arm ringers and hammer locks and whatnot the WWE uses are useless in shoot grappling, but they look good. A lot of real submissions are difficult to distinguish what is going on at a distance. I think I prefer the look and show rather than faking authenticity.
I would disagree. I think there's a lot of pro wrestling spots that are like a hammerlock. It's a Kimura. It works significantly, and in pro wrestling, it's not a finishing spot. Nor is typically an armbar. I mean, outside of Alberto Del Rio, and Kushida, an armbar is usually just a spot for the babyface to sit in for a while and then get the rope break.
But it can be a finisher.
It can be. The difference is, if it's treated like a finish, any finish to me gets over by how you book it. If it's shown as a move that people tap out from instantly, it'll get over.
It's an interesting question, to bring up now, because I think the public in general is so much more educated on what legitimate submissions might look like. So you do have an existing vocabulary for people to know that, a triangle it could be a legit finish, or a rear naked choke could be a legit finish. But I think there's room for both. And I think the best is when you can have something look convincing, but also look nice and twisty, like a PTO, like the Pager's move, I think would never work, obviously, but it looks great. And it looks painful for the person taking it. So I think there's definitely a nice balance, but in relation to a match like the submission match that was on this show, they were really going for realism. So I would have liked to, I prefer to see some more realistic looking moves, but in the end, it just depends on what your audience is kind of familiar with. If it's a sharpshooter or a figure four, then it's that. But these days, it might also be a rear naked choke or a twister or something that's never been used in wrestling before.
All right, so that wraps up our look at WWF Backlash, and we sent out a tweet asking people for any requests for next week. So I'm going to run some options by Way, and he is going to decide what we are going to do next week.
All right, let's do it.
Okay. Some of these I'm going to omit because I have no interest in watching them, but we appreciate everyone. Okay, one was about any old Smoky Mountain episodes, which are on the network. We've also got the May 10th, 1999 edition of Raw, which is the highest rated Raw ever.
What's on that show?
That was prior to the... That would have been 2 weeks before the Over the Edge pay-per-view, actually, where Owen Hart passed away. And it was on a night when I believe they were unopposed, with Nitro not on. So
what were the segments? Is that the This Is Your Life?
No. That was later in the year.
If I recall, it featured Vince McMahon versus Ken Shamrock as one of the matches on there. Okay. Which, I mean, here we are. Still a possible match one day.
Ken Shamrock versus Vince?
Oh, yeah.
I suppose they're both still somewhat on TV.
Imagine if Bellator could get that one together. Maybe Shane McMahon would be the better option. I wonder if Shane McMahon, I mean, that'd be an interesting fight.
Oh.
Shane and Ken.
Yeah, let me see what else is on this.
We've got a request for a Shimmer 80.
Ken Shamrock, Steve Austin.
Oh, okay.
Billy Gunn and Kane.
Sounds like 1999.
Austin, Rock, and Vince defeated Taker, Triple H, and Shane. Okay.
There's one for Lockdown 2008 where Samoa Joe wins the title, which was in the exact same city where he won the NXT title last week.
Okay, that's not a bad one. Yeah, didn't we do that?
Lockdown? No.
We haven't done. Was that the angle match?
Yes.
Okay, that might be interesting. Yeah.
ROH, Death Before Dishonor 2003, Judgment Day 2002.
Let's do the TNA.
You want to do TNA Lockdown?
Yeah.
Okay. Lockdown 2008 it will be for next week.
I can't remember the last time we did a TNA.
It's been a while. But, of course, Samoa Joe won the NXT title last week in Lowell, Massachusetts, which is where this match took place. Perhaps the best build-up to a main event in TNA history. And a pay-per-view that did well by TNA standards. Very well. So we will go back and take a look at that and kind of segue as well from the angle Benoit match we just saw. I mean, this was a match that was worked completely different.
Yep.
And something that the audience certainly responded to. Something different. What a concept.
Awesome.
So next week, TNA Lockdown 2008 will be reviewed. And that is all for us, folks. Thank you for listening. And taking us out is the only person possible to end a review of Backlash 2001.
Who's that?
We're going to look inside WWF New York, and Steve Blackman's there. Steve, I'll tell you what, you've been in a ring with Shane McMahon. What do you think of that last move? What can you say about it? You've been there with him.
What's going on, JR?
I just, what were your, did you see what Shane just did?
I sure did.